Here's a look at our top stories this hour. The World Bank says Ukraine's economy will contract over 45% this year due to the war with Russia, adding Moscow will also see its GDP shrinking by over 11%. Vote counting continues across France as partial results show incumbent President Emmanuel Macron is ahead of far-right contender Marine Le Pen. Also ahead, Israeli forces shoot dead another Palestinian youth south of the city of Bethlehem as tensions continue to rise across the occupied West Bank over the regime's aggressions. Hello and welcome. We're coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. The World Bank has forecast a bleak economic outlook for Ukraine and the region amid Russia's military operation in the country. In a report, the bank predicted that Ukraine's economy will collapse by more than 45% this year. The projected figure is far worse than the 10 to 35% downturn the International Monetary Fund predicted last month. The bank added that Russia will also see a more than 11% decline in its GDP. The World Bank said the entire region is suffering from economic consequences as a result of the war, adding the conflict has caused prices of grains and energy to shoot up as well. The Washington-based institution reiterated that this is the second major shock to hit the regional economy in 2 years after the coronavirus pandemic. The United States has reaffirmed commitment to supplying arms to Ukraine in its ongoing conflict with Russia. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said his country will provide Ukraine with weapons it needs so that it would be able to beat back Russia. Sullivan added, Washington has been working round the clock to deliver such weapons. That's why the Ukrainian president has expressed skepticism that Washington would arm Kyiv in a way it has vowed to do. In an interview with CBS News, Volodymyr Zelensky said he doesn't have the confidence that his country will be receiving the much-needed arms. He also called on the EU to impose more sanctions on Moscow. In a telephone conversation with the German chancellor, Zelensky demanded embargo on Russian oil and gas. Germany has so far resisted doing so due to its heavy reliance on Russian energy. However, Germany's gas imports from Russia have been cut by around 15%. And the United Nations says over 4.5 million Ukrainians have fled their country since the start of Russia's offensive in late February. According to UN figures, 90% of the refugees are women and children, as Ukrainian authorities do not allow men of military age to leave the country. A further 7.1 million people are said to be internally displaced. The UN also says over 200,000 non-Ukrainians have fled over the past 2 months. Poland hosts the largest number of refugees. Romania, Moldova, and Hungary are among other countries witnessing an influx of Ukrainian refugees. Europe is facing its biggest refugee crisis since World War II. The Russian Human Rights Commissioner confirms that Moscow and Kyiv have carried out another prisoner exchange despite an ongoing conflict between the two neighbors. Tatiana Moskalkova says four employees of Russia's Atomic Energy Corporation have returned home from Ukraine. According to the commissioner, some Russian soldiers and civilians have also been freed. The move includes the release of a number of Russian and Ukrainian truck drivers as well. Ukraine has confirmed the latest prisoner swap. The deputy prime minister says a dozen Ukrainian soldiers and 14 civilians have been freed as part of the prisoner swap. This was the third exchanges of soldiers and civilians held by Kyiv and Moscow since the start of the conflict. Now to the presidential election in France. Vote counting has begun across the country amid a low voter turnout. Partial results show incumbent President Emmanuel Macron is ahead of far-right contender Marine Le Pen. Macron has scored more than 27% of the vote, while Le Pen has gained over 25.5%. That means the election will go to a runoff, with the top two contenders facing off on April the 24th. Meanwhile, Macron said nothing is decided yet, urging citizens not to vote for Le Pen when the two go head-to-head in the next round. In a speech to his supporters, Macron said he would reach out to all who want to work for France. He added France and Europe are at a decisive stage. In the meantime, Le Pen said she would heal France's divisions if elected president.
The presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Par rapport à Marine Le Pen, peut-être les gens...
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
Il est brillant, il est...
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat. In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined. Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Romain Mazahari, Paris.
Italy's nurses and healthcare workers have staged a national strike affecting hospitals across the country. Unionists are calling on the government to review the collective contract, adjusting salaries to meet changes in skyrocketing cost of living. Here's more.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike, demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses had been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten. About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany, and 11 in France. Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years, a system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli forces have fatally shot another Palestinian youth on the West Bank as the regime intensifies its aggressions in the occupied territories. Mohammed Al-Irani, who had served time in Israeli jails, was killed by the regime's forces in the south of the city of Bethlehem. This brings to three the number of Palestinians killed in a single day. Earlier, Israeli troops shot dead a woman in the city of Al-Khalil, while another woman was killed near the city of Bethlehem. The regime has ramped up its attacks across the occupied territories following a series of Palestinian operations against Israelis. Palestinian resistance groups say the operations are a legitimate response to Israeli crimes and occupation. In Pakistan, members of the party of the post-Prime Minister Imran Khan say they will resign en masse from national and provincial assemblies. The move is expected to deepen the ongoing political crisis in Pakistan, which began after a no-trust motion against Khan. We've discussed that issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
And now it is time for this edition of the news review. Pakistan's political drama is entering a new stage. Members of the Tehreek-e-Insaf party that deposed Prime Minister Imran Khan say they will resign en masse from the national and provincial assemblies. Senior party official says that the resignations will start from the National Assembly on Monday after the election of the Prime Minister. Their decision comes hours after Khan lost a no-confidence vote in Parliament. Opposition leader Shahbaz Sharif is the most likely to succeed Khan. The political crisis began last week when Khan blocked a no-confidence motion by the opposition and dissolved the National Assembly. Later in the week, Pakistan's Supreme Court ruled that Khan's move was unlawful. The toppled prime minister has described the events as a foreign conspiracy of a regime change. He has called for street protests. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent, Kamran Youssef, who is joining us live from Islamabad. And also, we have with us Uday Bashkar, a security and strategic affairs analyst, who's joining us from Lucknow. Let's begin with our correspondent, Kamran Youssef. If you could please give us an update on the situation, exactly how have developments been unfolding?
Well, at the moment, former Prime Minister Imran Khan's supporters are staging protests in different parts of the country. There is also a protest taking place in the capital, Islamabad. The hundreds of people are there to show support to former Prime Minister Imran Khan. As you know, that he was ousted from power through a vote of no confidence last night in a high political drama that was there for several days. And today what happened was that the opposition leader nominated Shehbaz Sharif, the younger brother of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, to be the candidate for Prime Minister. And former Prime Minister Imran Khan also held a meeting with party leaders, and they have decided to resign from the National Assembly because they feel that a person like Shehbaz Sharif, who according to them is facing many corruption allegations, should not become Prime Minister of Pakistan. So this is their strategy, and we are also told that from 12th of April, the former Prime Minister Imran Khan is going to launch a mass campaign against the incoming government, and he is seeking early elections.
So, Mr. Bashkar, as we heard, Imran Khan has actually said that this was all a plot to topple him, a plot by the U.S. So could you elaborate more on that?
Prime Minister Imran Khan, perhaps one has to refer to him now as the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, had been making these allegations that the United States, and he also specifically named an official from the U.S. State Department as being the foreign forces, the foreign elements that were trying to topple his government. And therefore, in his very emotional address to the people of Pakistan last night, he had pitched the entire issue as a case of Pakistan's national sovereignty and that it must be protected from such malignant foreign influences, in this case the United States. But whether or not this would resonate with the people of Pakistan is still a question mark. And as your correspondent has just pointed out, I think Mr. Imran Khan is expecting that there would be a surge of support on the street when he has threatened to invoke the power of the people, as he calls it, the street power, which we are told will take place on the 12th of April, which is a Tuesday. So that is where I think he's now taking his own case. And I would say that at the moment, it's a bit uncertain because, as your correspondent has just pointed out, Pakistan is likely to have a new prime minister tomorrow, which is Monday morning, Pakistan time. As of now, the support for the former prime minister, Mr. Imran Khan, and his party, the PTI, appears to be muted. But here, I think, is a very interesting dimension of how street support is manifest in the politics of Pakistan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Uday Bhaskar, security and the strategic affairs analyst, and also our correspondent, Kamran Youssef. Thank you very much for joining us and sharing your views on this edition of the News Review. And thanks to all of our viewers for watching this edition.
Iranian lawmakers have signed a statement addressed to President Ebrahim Raisi, setting conditions for the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. More than 250 MPs signed a statement. They said the U.S. must provide legal guarantees approved by its Congress that Washington will not quit the agreement as it did in 2018. Signatories also demanded the U.S. remove the sanctions it imposed after exiting the JCPOA and avoid putting new measures. They also referred to the so-called snapback mechanism that allows the return of sanctions in case of Iran's noncompliance. The legislators said under a revived deal, there should be guarantees that the U.S. does not use the mechanism under various excuses. The MPs also stressed that Iran must be able to export its oil at the pre-sanctions level.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. President Biden was livid. He had been in office only 2 months, and there was already a crisis at the southwest border of the United States. Thousands of migrant children were jammed into unsanitary border patrol stations. Republicans were accusing Mr. Biden of flinging open the borders, and his aides were blaming one another. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Zolan Kano Young, Michael Shear, and Eileen Sullivan. The piece is titled Disagreement and Delay, How Infighting Over the Border Divided the White House. President Biden was livid. He had only been in office for 2 months, and there was already a crisis at the southwest border of the United States. Thousands of migrant children were jammed into unsanitary border patrol stations. Republicans were accusing Mr. Biden of flinging open the borders, and his aides were blaming one another. Facing his bickering staff in the Oval Office, that day in late March 2021, Joe Biden grew so angry at their attempts to duck responsibility that he erupted. "Who do I need to fire?" he demanded, "to fix this." Joe Biden came into office promising to dismantle what he described as the inhumane immigration policies of his predecessor, Donald J. Trump. But the episode, recounted by several people who attended or were briefed on the meeting, helps explain why that effort remains incomplete. For much of Joe Biden's presidency so far, the White House has been divided by furious debates over how and whether to proceed in the face of a surge of migrants crossing the southwest border of the United States. Senior Biden aides have been battling one another over how quickly to roll back the most restrictive policies and what kind of system would best replace them. Now Mr. Biden finds himself the target of attacks from all sides. Immigration activists accuse him of failing to prioritize the human rights of millions of immigrants. Conservatives have pointed to surges of migrants at the border as evidence that the president is weak and ineffective. And even some moderate Democrats now fear that lifting Trump-era border restrictions could hurt them politically. Officials from the Department of Homeland Security expect record numbers of migrants to cross the border this summer, just months ahead of the midterm elections that will determine control of Congress and help shape the arc of Joe Biden's presidency for the next 2 years. This account of the Biden administration's handling of the border over the past 15 months is based on interviews with 20 current and former officials, lawmakers and activists, most of whom requested anonymity to discuss private deliberations. President Biden came into office with high hopes, saying he wanted a system that would allow the United States to determine in a more compassionate way which migrants should be allowed to stay in the country. He recruited a team of immigration advocates and others eager to put in place the humane system they had envisioned for years. But the slow pace of change has left some of Joe Biden's longtime allies doubting his commitment and wondering whether he is more interested in keeping the highly charged issue from dominating his presidency. Virtually all of the aides who came on board early in the Biden administration have left the White House, frustrated by what they describe as repeated fights with some of the president's most senior advisers over whether to lift Trump-era policies. Even some of Joe Biden's more enforcement-minded aides have departed. White House officials did not dispute the internal disagreements over immigration. Vedant Patel, a spokesman for Mr. Biden, said the president understood that changing an outdated system was not going to happen overnight. Though he said, Joe Biden was working every day to secure our border and use the power we do have to build a fair, orderly and humane immigration system. But the border has been a constant headache for President Biden, one that ballooned into a series of crises even as he tried to stay focused on the coronavirus pandemic, the economy, Afghanistan, and the conflict in Ukraine. Our old debates about border security and deterrence and open borders are not capturing the actual policy challenge at hand, said Andrea Flores, who resigned as a director for border management at the National Security Council, disillusioned and frustrated by senior aides and the opportunities I saw them not take. Ron Klain issued a warning to his staff last summer. The White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, gathered senior aides, including Susan Rice, the president's domestic policy advisor, Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, the Homeland Security advisor, and Amy Pope, the top migration advisor, in the Roosevelt Room. Ron Klain told them that they needed to make sure the administration was not pandering to people who wanted an immediate end to Trump-era border restrictions, according to two people familiar with his comments. If they did not find a way to deter soaring illegal crossings at the southwest border of the United States, he said, accusations about border chaos would grow worse, anger moderate voters, and potentially sink the party during the 2022 midterm elections. The White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, was channeling his boss, who had complained to top aides about the intensifying attacks from Republicans, characterizing him as an open border president, according to a person familiar with Mr. Biden's comments. But the source of President's frustration was as much from inside his administration as it was from outside. As border crossings increased, disagreements erupted over how quickly to dismantle Donald Trump's anti-immigrant policies and what to replace them with. Record numbers of migrants, including people driven out of their homes in Central America by the economic effects of the pandemic, gangs and natural disasters, surged to the border last summer, in part enticed by Joe Biden's promise of a less harsh approach to immigration than that of his predecessor. About 214,000 migrants were taken into custody in July of last year, the first time that many people had been apprehended in a single month in more than two decades. Joe Biden has taken a series of actions to reverse his predecessor's policies. He halted construction of the border wall, created a task force to reunite families separated at the border, and reversed Donald Trump's ban on considering domestic violence or gang violence as a basis for asylum. He also proposed sweeping legislation to overhaul the nation's immigration system, though it has stalled in Congress. But despite those actions, the infighting among the president's aides was on full display during the Oval Office meeting last March. Xavier Becerra, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, whose department runs shelters for migrant children, said the Department of Homeland Security needed to be aggressive in turning away older teenagers, which would have changed President Biden's policy of letting all unaccompanied migrant children into the country. Ms. Rice repeatedly said that Xavier Becerra should provide more shelters. Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, said the Department of Health and Human Services needed to move the children more quickly out of overcrowded Border Patrol stations. Ron Klain, the White House Chief of Staff, tried to play the mediator, to little effect. For months, aides clashed over an effort intended to speed up consideration of asylum cases at the border by allowing immigration officers to decide the claims rather than the overburdened judges. The goal was to streamline a court process that currently takes an average of 5 years to reach a decision for asylum seekers. Some of the former immigration advocates in the West Wing, including Ms. Rice's Deputy for Immigration, Esther Olivaria, worried that rushing through the new process would limit due process for migrants. Ms. Rice, Ron Klain, and others argued that processing claims faster, swiftly deporting migrants who fail to win asylum, was an important way to ease the burden on the system and deter illegal crossings. As the year went on, Joe Biden grew annoyed by the delays in putting the asylum changes into practice along the U.S. border with Mexico. In meetings on immigration with his top aides, he often asked what resources and funding the team of former advocates and immigration veterans needed for the policy. The administration did not release the final language for the new policy until last month. And because of staffing and funding issues, the plan will be rolled out slowly and not in time to offer significant help with the expected spike in migrants seeking asylum later on this spring. One of the most fraught debates inside the West Wing over the last year has been what to do about Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, which forced migrants seeking asylum to wait south of the border until their cases were decided. human rights advocates assailed the conditions in Mexico, where migrants often stayed in squalid camps, where they had no legal representation and were at risk of assault. As a candidate, Joe Biden had condemned the program. Once in office, he quickly terminated it. But it was one program that had been effective at keeping some migrants out of border detention facilities. During a meeting last summer convened to discuss options for dealing with the record numbers of migrants at the U.S. border, Ms. Sherwood Randall raised the possibility of restoring the program with some additional protections for migrants, according to two people familiar with the matter. That idea horrified immigration advocates inside the Biden administration, who viewed it not only as a breach of Joe Biden's campaign pledge, but also as a retreat from the promise of a more humane immigration system. Joe Biden, too, appeared uncomfortable with the idea, according to a person who was in the room for the meeting. The president told his team he would not forbid them to explore whether it was worth restoring the Remain in Mexico policy, but he made it clear that he did not want the idea leaking to the news media, and he did not want his name attached to it. The Supreme Court would later force the Biden administration to restore the Trump-era policy.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and we present you a thought-provoking saying from the Prophet's 7th infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, regarding his illustrious ancestor, Abu Talib, the uncle and guardian of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and defender of Islam. Abu Talib was the repository of the trust given to the past prophets, and he was the medium for their transfer to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, whose prophethood and divine mission he acknowledged.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanu la'inu rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights, and we are looking at justice. from the perspective of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam. Human rights pretty much falls in every aspect of our life. It is not limited to one thing. So whatever problem that we have and whatever category of life we have, human rights obviously falls into it. We saw that in the letter of Amir al-Mu'mineen to his commander Malik al-Ashtar, that Amir al-Mu'mineen discussed many aspects of the human life and human affairs that requires the maintenance of human rights. Amongst the things that human rights come into play in is in times of peace and treaties. So Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam also gives specific instructions to his commander Malik when it comes to peace and treaties that he needs to make sure is applied, which is a right of people. He says to him, bear in mind that you do not throw away the offer of peace which your enemy may himself make. Now, that's an extremely important concept. Sometimes when you have enemies, peace is the best way. Making a treaty with your enemy is the best way. In peace, you secure not only the rights of people, but you secure their right to living. Because in war and during war, life is lost. And the first, you know, if we are looking at human rights, the first human right that anyone should have is the right to live. So as a ruler, as a government, I should not be seeking war with my enemies. Rather, I should be seeking peace. So with peace, I preserve the life. And he says, accept it, for that will please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The pleasure of Allah in terms of when it comes to enemies is that he wants to see peace rather than war. Because obviously we said with war, we lose life. With peace, we gain life. He says to him, peace is a source of comfort to the army. It is not just the people, the army themselves. They are the ones that will suffer the most. They are the ones who will have to fight. Their life will be lost. Their families that will be affected as a result. When the armies know that their country and their government is trying to create peace rather than war, it gives them comfort. It gives them a source of happiness. It gives them a source of pride. But when they know that their government cares about nothing but wars, then that does not really help the armies, does it? It does the opposite. He says to him, it reduces your worries and promote order in the state. Sometimes when people know there's going to be a war and the drums of war are happening, people are distorted, people are stressed out, people are not happy anymore, people are in fear, people are worried. So it's a source of worry. Why should you put people in state? As we can see even recently when we look at certain countries who are threatened with war, you see that it's causing people fear, and that fear is not required. So as the right of the people to live in peace. So if it means that I have to make peace with my enemies for the sake of my people, then I should do so. Let us take a short break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So Amir al-Mu'mineen is saying, making peace with your enemies pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But he says to him, but beware, be on your guard when the peace is signed for. Certain types of enemies propose terms of peace just to lure you into a sense of security, only to attack you again when you are off your guard. And that's obviously a very straightforward, that when you make peace with your enemies, you have to keep your guard always on. Because that's enemies, and we can see classical example happening in our modern day today, where the enemies give you peace, but it just they just keeping you busy, just waiting for the right opportunity to come and attack you. And sometimes the attack doesn't have to be with guns. Sometimes it is, you know, with finance. Sometimes it is with sanctions. Sometimes it is, you know, even an online attack on your infrastructure. So the enemies work in mysterious ways. So therefore, because you signed a peace treaty with your enemy, it does not mean that you should lower your guard. So it says always be on your guard. So you should exercise the utmost vigilance on your part and place no undue faith in their pretension. So whatever they want to pretend to be, you know, they want to be peaceful or not, or they act like they are good doers, or sometimes we, when we look at some countries, they start a war, they initiate a war, they kill innocent people, and then they come up with peace treaties and treaties, and then they assume and try to pretend in front of people that they are seeking peace and they are champions of human rights and they care about the humans. They kill people, and they care about the diseases that are taking place, or poverty and how much people are dying. And then you have all this, you know, World Health Organization and UNICEF and what have you, Red Cross, who are coming from the same countries who starts these wars themselves, which defeats the purpose. So the Amir al-Mu'minin, salamullah alayhi, when he talks about peace, it is also a right of people. They need to have the right to peace of mind. He says to him, but if under the peace treaty you have accepted any obligation, discharge those obligations, and it is a trust and must be faithful, upheld, and whenever you have promised anything, keep it, when obviously in terms of dealing with other people and promising them, keep that promise, because as people, as believers, we were told that if we make a commitment and we make a promise to a person, we need to keep these promises. A peace treaty is required to save lives. Imam Hassan alayhi salam, the son of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, when he made a treaty with Muawiyah, was based on the fact that he wanted to save the lives of people, make sure that their lives are maintained. So when he signed that treaty, he had people in mind. He wanted to preserve the life of his followers, for example. He did not want to have bloodshed. He wanted to make sure that their lives are safe and guaranteed. And Imam alayhi salam, he lived up to the treaty and to the obligation that he put on himself. But on the other hand, the other party also had obligations. When Muawiyah took charge, he said the treaty of Imam al-Hassan, he says, like, it says, it is under my feet and I will not apply any of it. So obviously, one is trying to protect life and there are always others who try to take it. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله Cultural news Social news Scientific news Artistic news. With delight.
A restaurant in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta is taking fine dining to new heights, literally and figuratively, by giving diners a one-of-a-kind experience 50 meters above ground. The restaurant is called Lounge in the Sky. Diners are securely strapped into seats fixed to a table and are hoisted into the air using a heavy-duty lift. First, the gourmet meals are prepared in the main kitchen. Then, the food is loaded onto the platform where the dishes are plated and served to the patrons. The suspended guests are able to take advantage of breathtaking views as they gently rotate at great heights.
At first, it was not easy. I was nervous that I wouldn't be able to swallow the food, let alone drink. But after some time, I could eventually eat. It was thrilling.
While enjoying the meals, the guests use seat belts and the accompanying staff are equipped with safety harnesses. The guests are also briefed on safety regulations before the platform is raised. Diners call the one-hour experience exhilarating and worth the high price. The project developers say the restaurant was aimed at reviving local and international tourism sector after a big slump during the COVID-19 pandemic. The culinary experience is a first in Indonesia and the third in the world after Belgium and Malaysia. A new selfie museum in Sweden is flipping the script by making visitors both the artist and the exhibit. The establishment is dubbed the Museum and is in a shopping mall in Stockholm. Unlike other selfie museums, this one has no works of art on its walls. Instead, its brightly decorated rooms are meant to serve as fun backgrounds for visitors to take their selfies or shoot videos in. Other rooms let the visitors bury themselves in candy-colored foam bricks, strike a pose under neon lights, or sit on a huge, colorful swing. The manager says the museum is interactive and lets the visitors be the artists themselves in order to create the art they want to see. The drone show Korea 2022 has been held at the Busan Exhibition and Convention Center, BEXCO. It featured 137 companies and 533 booths, making this year's incarnation the largest in the show's six-year history. The event also featured the participation of a large international industry representatives from Japan and Western Europe. A highlight of this year's event was military technology centered around the unveiling of new indigenous UAVs. This year's show marks a long-endurance liquid hydrogen drone produced by a South Korean company. These developments reflect South Korea's attempt to improve resilience and revolutionize its approach to warfare. The event puts on display the importance of drone industry in various spheres, including defense purposes. More than 163 wildlife species have been released back into lagoons and forests in Colombia's Casanare province after being seized and rehabilitated by authorities fighting wildlife trafficking. These include 15 different species such as anteaters, turtles, macaws, a toucan, and a leopard. They were nurtured back to health by fauna vets from an environmental authority in charge of managing sustainable development. The authority, Corporinoquia, released more than 1,200 animals back into the wild in 2021 alone. Colombia is one of the world's most biodiverse countries by square kilometer and is home to some 10% of the world's flora and fauna.
A super rare birth has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered 8 miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching, along with other threats, has brought the species to the brink of extinction.
With neon lights on the floor and walls, pulsing electronic beats, and a glowing red shuttlecock bouncing back and forth, Malaysian badminton court evokes a sci-fi movie set. Shuttle in the Dark is a badminton hall in the iconic Petronas Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was set up in late 2021 by a sport management company to encourage people to take up the racket sport after 2 years of social restrictions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Director of INIC Sport Management says the initial goal was to draw sports fans and players back into action.
Our initial goal was, how can we encourage and gain back the interest of people to come back and play? And not only those enthusiasts, but then as well the new people who was not able to or never play badminton before. So that's why we come out with this experience called Shuttle in the Dark.
Playing on a futuristic court presents an unusual challenge for athletes as they have to adjust their eyes to the darkness to play. Badminton is one of the most popular sports in Malaysia and Asia, with a thriving community in the Southeast Asian community. It has produced some of the world's top-ranked players.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A zoo in Ireland's capital, Dublin, has unveiled its newest habitat called the Himalayan Hills, a brand new home of the red panda and snow leopard. Visitors are able to see the red panda's habitat by traveling along the new trail around a rocky edge to an open viewing area. The red pandas are typically climbing, exploring, or munching on bamboo at the top of broad-leafed evergreen trees. The expanded habitat was designed with a red panda's tree-dwelling lifestyle in mind. Also, visitors can gaze up at the 15-meter rocky slope through an impressive panoramic viewing area to spot the snow leopards. These elusive felines are typically nocturnal, so catching a glimpse of one is a rare treat.
Yeah, the animals are settling in well. We've tried to recreate the wild habitats in the Himalayan hills. Both species live quite high up. In case of the snow leopards, up to 5,000 meters on these very steep rocky slopes, which you can see here in the habitat as well. We've tried to use the topology of Dublin Zoo.
The project took a few years to complete. It was halted in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic and massive budget shortages, but was restarted after government funding in 2021. The zoo is part of a protection project for red pandas and snow leopards. These animals are listed as vulnerable due to threats from poaching and severe habitat loss. Ancient Pompeii has a new guardian, Spot, a four-legged robot dog that will inspect the ancient Italian city's streets and tunnels to identify structural issues. The robot, designed by the U.S. firm Boston Dynamics, will patrol Pompeii at nighttime. The robot inspects the smallest of spaces and gathers data for planning interventions to fix safety and structural issues. Equipped with a 360-degree camera, Spot will also protect the city's streets from illegal relic hunters who cause structural damage to the ruins by digging tunnels. Pompeii will also have its own eye in the sky, a Leica BLK-2 flying laser scanner capable of autonomously conducting 3D scans of the ruins, helping Spot carry out its tasks. Safeguarding ancient sites from treasure hunters has always been a problem for every country, especially the ancient ones.
The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village known today as the Takalik Abaj Archaeological Park was occupied for 1,700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Takalik Abaj is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even minor spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
According to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics, around 230,000 people in Gaza